of the nightcap on a historic night for the folks about 4.5 hours west of us in San Diego. Now, it didn't happen at Petco Park, but the San Diego Padres get their first no-hitter in franchise history. The number floating around on Twitter, 8,206 games prior to a no-hitter. The only active team without a no-hitter was the San Diego Padres. They get it done. Joe Musgrove, the man, 9 innings. No hits, no runs, no walks, one-hit batter, and 10 strikeouts for Joe Musgrove. What a performance tonight. And for the San Diego Padres, they win 3-0. If you're wondering, total was 9, slightly juiced to the under. Well, under. And the Padres were minus 124 on the run line tonight down in Texas. Jeff Parles, Tim Murray. Fun little Friday, you know? We got the NBA card. It's not the greatest, but we get a no-hitter, so that's always nice.
Now that's a good way to complete our Masters Friday,
yeah,
to say the very least. It's funny, Tim, the NBA card really has not delivered other than the Celtics being taken to overtime and then covering an 8.5-point spread in said overtime.
And also, Jason Tatum dropped 53 in that
game. Not bad. But the weird ones, though, you have a 9 spot in hockey tonight. The St. Louis Blues have scored 9 in their game against Minnesota, who's pretty good.
Yeah. I'm just looking at something, if this is a true tweet.
Oh,
at Sully Baseball.
So the good thing with Sully, Tim, since the season has begun, every single day that the Padres have played, he has thrown out, will be the day that X throws a no-hitter. So he got a ride with Joe Musgrove today.
And it didn't take that long.
It didn't take that long.
So the San Diego Padres get the no-hitter. I was going down a rabbit hole during the break. I guess when we didn't have sports, ESPN.com put together the greatest pitching performances per game score, which is who's the originator of game score?
I forget who it was, Tim.
Bill James.
Was it Bill James?
Yeah, Bill James. As Aaron Oster gets in our ear. But there, as you would imagine, you go back in the day, there's some ridiculous ones. But this is up there. What, it was like 97, 98?
97 today for Musgrove.
So one of the very, very impressive performance. No surprise. You look at the stat line, the strikeouts, no walks, 112 pitches. So he gets it done. And once again, first no-hitter in Padres franchise history. We're going to talk some NFL draft, by the way, in just a couple of moments. But let's get you updated on the NBA board right now. We are in the fourth quarter, and the Charlotte Hornets are up 112-94 over the Milwaukee Bucks. Now, I think most people know about the injuries that the Hornets are dealing with. No LaMelo Ball, no Malik Monk, and no Gordon Hayward. And they're still up by 18 on the road. Well, why is that? Because Giannis is out, Chris Middleton is out, Brooke Lopez is out, Dante Delaware Jordan DiVincenzo is out, Drew Holiday is out, and PJ Tucker is out. That is a bit of a recipe for a tricky situation there for the Milwaukee Bucks, who, by the way, opened. You could have got this, Jeff, at one point in time. You could have got the Hornets +9.5. And they end up a 3-point favorite. +9 is what you could have gotten. And looking where it opened, you could have gotten, if you had had an indication, a feeling of where the wind would blow, you could have got +380 on the money line on Charlotte as they lead by 18 midway through the fourth quarter.
Well, some person who wanted to find something to bet at about 2 o'clock in the morning last night. Found themselves a diamond in the rough with that one, Tim. Again, who needs closing line value tonight with that one?
No, there's no doubt. And remember when we talked about, Clippers, only Paul George is out? What's going on? They're up 13 with 2 minutes to go in the second quarter.
They stabilized.
As you would imagine, against one of the worst teams, if not the worst team in the NBA, the Houston Rockets. We'll get you updated. I know you've been waiting very patiently. The Wizards do lead the Golden State Warriors by 7 late in the second quarter. NFL draft talk, that's what you really want. Coming up in just a moment. It is the the nightcap here on VSiN Live from the Circus Sportsbook. Hour number two on a wrap-up. What do they call it? Moving day, right? Is it
Saturday's usually moving day.
Saturday's moving day. Today, we had some big names missing the cut, and we'll get to what those odds would have been, but Patrick Cantlay misses the cut. Rory McIlroy misses the cut. Your defending champ, Dustin Johnson, misses the cut. Brooks Koepka, which I don't think is that big of a surprise. Actually, Jeff, I was searching in town trying to find a Brooks Koepka to miss the cut prop. I couldn't personally find it. A couple people did tweet me, said they found it around plus 250. So a nice cash there for Brooks Koepka to miss the cut. So appreciate the tweet there. And then Sergio. A one-time champ, missed the cut there. So some big names missing the cut. Phil Mickelson did ultimately make the cut there for the Masters. And your leader still is Justin Rose. We're looking for, I believe, what is it? Only five people have led wire to wire?
Correct. Five have led wire to wire, and Jordan Spieth was the last one to do it.
Right.
He was right now the betting favorite at most spots, just two shots back. And look, we talked about it earlier. Justin Rose looked like it was going to be a really bad day for him, mm-hmm. and really stabilized the ship over the last six holes to get it from fell all the way to four under, got it back to seven where he started the day.
Just a quick update on. Sorry, I can't stop laughing. Clippers and Rockets. The Rockets led 36-26 after the first quarter. There are 24 seconds left in the second quarter. The Clippers have outscored the Rockets 41-8.
Yep. That's a competitive quarter, Tim.
Yeah. So if you're worried, you're in good shape there with your Clippers laying double digits. With that, let's get to a little NFL draft discussion. And if you like the NFL draft, you need to get in on the Draft Network. It is tremendous stuff. So many great folks over there, and one of them is Benjamin Solak, who joins us right now. And it is draft season. It's late back on the East Coast. We appreciate him joining us. Benjamin, let's start with, I think, the topic du jour when it comes to the NFL draft right now. Who is going to go number three? I understand the way the wind is blowing in favor of Mac Jones, but people like yourself and others out there in the draft analyzing business just doesn't seem to add up why he would be number three. So what is your feeling on who is going to be the 49ers selection at number three?
Yeah, so I think the initial wind blew such that we were thinking Mac Jones. Over the last 24 hours in Vegas, the line has come down pretty significantly towards Justin Fields, which there was no way there wasn't going to at some point be a swing. That's just kind of how, you know, when you're 3-4 weeks out, that's going to be the nature of the markets and reacting to news. But the reality is, for as much as there's no real reason for the Niners to conceal who it is they particularly like, they're not going to yell out here and just say who they think it is. And so there was the tie to Mac Jones. We see that Justin Fields is going to have a second pro day that Shanahan is going to attend. It was announced that Trey Lance is going to have a second pro day. It's likely that Shanahan's going to attend that. I think all three of those quarterbacks are within range. And yes, Kyle Shanahan has made his hay in the league, taking pocket passers and average athletes and churning out some really good passing offenses. We get the sense that, not unlike Sean McVay, who went and acquired Matt Stafford this year, Shanahan's kind of done with this. I need like a quarterback with a little bit more talent. So yeah, I do think it's Justin Fields or Trey Lance. I would be surprised if it is Mac Jones by the time we get there.
Well, let's just go for the sake of the argument here, since Jones is still the favorite right now to be the third overall pick, and we'll say he goes to San Francisco here. If you're looking to make a bet on the fourth quarterback to go, would you expect Fields to come off the board first, or would you expect Lance to be the next guy off?
I would still expect Fields. While Lance is an extremely likable prospect, this is the sort of player the league typically gravitates away from, the sort of player the league's typically apprehensive of. And that's because it's a one-year starter at the FCS level. One-year starting quarterbacks at the FBS level get viewed with a lot of criticism. With the limited experience, he's started only the same number of games as Mac Jones, but Mac Jones did it at Alabama. He did it against SEC defenses in the FBS National Championship. Trey Lance does not have the experience teams typically look for, especially in their lower-level prospects. So to me, it'll be Justin Fields. I think Lance will go top 15, and I think Lance's talent is such that if a team took an early gamble on him, like Atlanta at four, I wouldn't be too surprised. But again, this is the sort of player that it takes a lot to be fully faithful in, at least in the league's perspective. And so it's a tough bet to make for him to go any earlier than QB5.
We're talking to Benjamin Solak from the Draft Network, and they do such fine work. Make sure to check them out on social media and online. At Benjamin Solak is where you can find him on Twitter. Let's get to wide receivers. I saw you tweeting a little bit about Ja'Marr Chase today. There's a lot of love in the marketplace, from analysts about Ja'Marr Chase and just kind of breaking down talent and the odds out there at DraftKings. The over-under on draft position is 6.5. Benjamin, I kind of look at it as saying, man, that's, you have to lay a little bit of juice on the under at minus 134. Where do you think Ja'Marr Chase ultimately goes off the board?
Yeah, it is tricky. I think that 6.5 is tempting, but I also recognize the juice is a little bit of a trap.
Right.
The expectation is that the combined weight of the Bengals at 5, who are evidently looking into Ja'Marr Chase to pair with Joe Burrow, they don't really have a wide receiver 1 right now. They've got a good group, but not necessarily a deep group or a top talent group. And so Ja'Marr Chase at 5 to the Bengals on the board. And then the Miami Dolphins at 6, also potentially in the wide receiver market. I think the Dolphins guy is Pitts, pretty much no matter what. The only way it's not Pitts is if the Falcons take him at 4. I'm not sure that the Falcons would stay at 4 to take a tight end. I think they'd rather trade that pick out for a quarterback if they're not going to take a quarterback themselves. So I think that the Chase under 6.5 is a little bit more confident than I'd like for it to be, and I wouldn't take it at this time. If he does not go at 5 to the Bengals, doesn't go at 6 to the Dolphins, I don't think he makes it much further than the Lions at 7, and that's why that line is there. So I expect him to be top 7, top 8 pick, but there's a little bit too much uncertainty top of the class. We haven't even talked about like Oregon offensive tackle Penei Sewell and his spot in the top 6 for me to say confidently Chase is going there. I think his board starts at 5 and ends around 7 or 8.
So then, Benjamin, we'll bring up Sewell then, since you just mentioned him there at the end. His slot right now, if you're betting this, it's a 5.5 with the juice, again, heavily on the under, nearly minus 140 on the under for Sewell. So based off the betting market, the assumption is that Cincinnati is going to pull the trigger on Sewell at number 5. Do you see that happening? And if he doesn't go at number 5, where does Sewell fall to?
Yeah, it's the same thing as Chase for me. I think he's got a good chance to go top 5. I don't like it at that price. That's too much for me. And if the Bengals do choose to make that Chase pick, and they do choose to invest in wide receiver, I think that it'll leave a little bit of a scramble behind them. The Dolphins at 6 could take Sewell and justify it. They took 2 tackles in the first 2 rounds last year, but Robert Hunt, their right tackle, is maybe a guard, so maybe they want to make that move, but we don't know about that. You start to get to the Panthers at 8. Taylor Moten on the franchise tag, traded away Russell Okung last year. They're a team that's going to look at Penei Sewell pretty significantly. So that 5-8 range, that's the same range for Chase, is probably also about the same range for Sewell. If Chase, you're getting 6.5, and with Sewell, you're getting 5.5. So you're getting twice the exposure on Chase, and you're getting a little bit less juice if memory serves. So to me, Sewell, that's too ambitious, especially because Chase is the closer we get being called more and more the consensus wide receiver 1, whereas Sewell remains non-consensus along with Rashawn Slater, the tackle out of Northwestern. So even then, you could have a team surprise and like Slater over Sewell. I don't like that too much. I think 5-8, 5-10 is the range for Sewell, but I wouldn't take him under 5.5.
Do you think we could see Rashawn Slater go ahead of Penei Sewell? Just looking at the odds right now, so for the first wide receiver selected, it's now minus 400 for Ja'Marr Chase, which, not that long ago, it was, I think, minus 125. So the odds have shifted and heavily in the favor of Ja'Marr Chase. And then it's plus 500 for both Devontae Smith and Jalen Waddle. Looking at old linemen, Penei Sewell, Ben, is minus 715 to be the first O lineman picked. And then Rashawn Slater is plus 350. Could we see a bit of a surprise on draft day with Rashawn Slater going ahead of Sewell?
Yeah, those odds are interesting because if memory serves, the third tackle is like Christian Darrisaw at 10 billion.
Yeah, you know what I mean? 33 to 1.
Yeah, everybody knows it's Slater or Sewell, and right now the guy is Sewell. The adage, the way we have to look at it, especially with the draft, is it takes one team. You know what I mean? It's not do 17 teams right. have Slater ranked above Sewell. It's does one, does two, and where are those teams? You look at a team like Atlanta at number four, who needs both a tackle and a guard. Slater is viewed as a more of a tackle guard potential convert than Sewell is. They come with a general manager in Terry Fontenot, who is heavily investing in offensive linemen in New Orleans. That front office, they prioritize athleticism, which is what you're really getting with Slater, is quickness and explosiveness. To a head coach and Arthur Smith that wants to be able to run the football using zone concepts and power concepts, you got to be scheme diverse. It's something Slater brings to the table because he's very intelligent. There's a way you talk yourself into this, is basically what I'm saying. And so I'm positive Sewell and Slater will be the first two tackles off the board. I'm not so positive in the order such that Sewell at 750 seems appropriate to me. I think it's closer than that. And we've been hearing that from the league since November. Like that since guys sat down on Slater and Sewell's film, both of whom were opt-outs, it's been, you know, this is not consensus. So this is not like a new thing, a pro day thing, a narrative yeah. thing. This has been around for a while. So I think it's legit.
Benjamin, I want to look at the defensive player market, the first player to be drafted on the defensive side of the ball. These odds, Tim and I talked about it a little bit yesterday, very interesting from DraftKings.
They've shifted this week, too.
They have, yes. And Micah Parsons now a co-favorite with Patrick Surtain II at plus 150. Kwity Paye out of Michigan at 4-1. J.C. Horn at 7-1. Everyone else is 10-1 or longer. Where would you go in that market?
The value there is J.C. Horn, and it's a ticket that I own, and I probably own too much of it, if we're going to be honest. J.C. is the sort of player coaches fall in love with. That's an angry son of a gun. At South Carolina, that film is gnarly. He's extremely physical. Surtain is a better scheme-diverse player, right? He fits more teams. Horn is more scheme-specific. He's got to play press man, but if your team plays press man, that's the player that you prefer. And you're going to take him with a top 10 value more confidently than you take a player like Patrick Surtain. So in the corner room, he's moving up. Coaches loving him means they're going to bang the table for him. And corner is a premium position. The team that's of interest here is Dallas at 10. Carolina at 8 is a potential take a corner. We'll see. I don't think they would. If they do, it's probably Surtain. But if Dallas at 10 is the first corner off the board, you're looking at a cover three Dan Quinn approach. It's going to ask a corner to dominate in a vertical third, a line at the line of scrimmage and be successful. That sounds to me like a team that would fall in love with J.C. Horn. Edge linebacker, the edge class isn't good enough this year.
Yeah.
I don't think any edge is a top 10 pick. And then linebacker in the top 10, the only way you're getting that is if it's Michael Parsons at 9 to the Broncos, which if Vic Fangio wants to make that pick, he does. But usually you don't see smart GMs like George Payton take off ball linebackers in the top 10. So to me, Horn is a player that's on the rise and is going to get more and more buzz as more and more coaches start to get their voices in draft rooms, which is something that happens over these last few weeks of draft season. So I think plus 700, it'll be the best number you get on Horn. If he's not the first defensive player picked, I get it. It's a weird class. It's a difficult class, but I don't think that number's getting lower than 700. I think it'll get much more even as we get closer.
Yeah, and to your point, I feel like, especially now, Benjamin, that the NCAA tournament's in our back, you know, in our rear view, people's eyes are shifted to the draft. I've heard a lot about J.C. Horn this week in particular. Running back's always interesting because last year, you know, Clyde Edwards-Helaire didn't come out of nowhere, but he was not the favorite to be the first running back selected. That was DeAndre Swift. This year, Najee Harris is your favorite in the betting market at -$1.50. And then it gets interesting. Travis Etienne, Javonte Williams out of UNC, and then the odds get much bigger. So when you look at those three, and we've got a board up right now showing the differences in the market, you can actually find a plus 450 on Javonte Williams if you like him, or a plus 225 on Travis Etienne if you like him to be the first running back selected. So whoever it is, probably end of the first round. Is it a slam dunk that it'll be Najee Harris, or could you see Etienne or Williams being that first running back selected?
I don't think it's a slam dunk, but I do think that Etienne, he was around like plus 1,100 early April last year. The rise was in large part because he brought three down value to the Chiefs specifically, who obviously made the pick, and they knew we're going to throw the football a lot, so we need this guy to have three down value, and Edwards-Helaire was such a good receiver. That player in this class is Najee Harris. Both Etienne and Javonte Williams have in their profile a lack of true defined receiving talent, whereas Harris, who is a very big back, we don't expect to be a very good receiver, is a natural receiver, and he has been for Alabama for a couple of years. And so I do not expect Javonte Williams to be early. If anybody's going to beat out Harris, I think it's going to be ETN. But I would say that if this pricing is appropriate, I think it's going to be Harris. The team to watch is the Steelers at 24. Pittsburgh in desperate need to reawaken their running game. Offensive line needs help as well. So if they're going to get a good tackle draw, a good guard draw, they could go that way. But Harris is a player they're going to love because of the physicality, because of the three down usage, because of the proven bell cow role at Alabama. To me, Najee Harris, he fits their bill. So I expect if there is a running back round one, it's Najee.
He is Benjamin Solak from the Draft Network. Great stuff, man. Appreciate it. And you better believe we'll be calling you before the draft comes around.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, fellas.
There he is. Benjamin Solak. Follow him on Twitter at Benjamin. S-O-L-A-K. That's Jeff Parles. I'm Tim Murray. Get you updated on all of the NBA action going on right now on a Friday night. Next on VSiN. Life is a marathon, not a sprint, unless you're hiring. Fortunately, Indeed has great tools that help speed up the hiring process. Visit Indeed.com/credit. Thanks again to Benjamin Solak for coming on. And now my mind is starting to race. I'm like, J.C. Horn, first player. Because initially I was thinking, okay, is Patrick Surtain? Because we talked about it earlier in the week. It might have been with JVT. We talked about it a little bit yesterday too, where Michael Parsons was odds on to be the first defensive player selected, and I think everyone was in agreement. Like, Michael Parsons is awesome. By the way, how you doing here? Oh,
we survived.
You wow.
Oh, that was fortunate. All right, well, the 5-team money line square parlay cashes.
And
that's very nice.
It goes without a sweat, and you needed You truly needed the money line on a bunch of these games.
Yeah, I did.
Denver went off 6.5 and I guess I should articulate why I was just screaming, wow. Denver beat San Antonio 121-119, and San Antonio had a layup, a tip-in, and another put-back opportunity all go begging as Denver holds on for a 2-point win at home against San Antonio tonight. And that was the closer.
Yeah, that was the final leg.
To Jeff's 5-leg money line parlay. Remind the folks what the first 4 legs were.
Yes, the square deal parlay comes home
Bring
tonight.
Bring it home.
Tim, the Indiana Pacers, who I needed the money line.
One did not cover.
Did not cover.
Pacers won 111-106 at Orlando. Went off as a 6.5-point favorite in most spots here in Las Vegas.
Boston against Minnesota, they did cover in overtime.
Yep.
8.5-point favorite, winning by 9. Denver as a 6.5-point favorite, winning by 2. And then on the ice, your Washington Capitals, who did not cover the puck line tonight.
You know it.
And the Pittsburgh Penguins against my home state, New Jersey Devils. They did cover the puck line. The Penguins did. But, hey, that's why you do the money line in these things. And the square deal parlay comes home.
Yeah, that's a good little Friday to bring it on home. I tell you what, man, I tried not to jinx it, didn't want to mush, but something about sitting next to me here these past couple of days, it doesn't do anything for me. What was that movie, Good Luck Chuck or something like that, with Dane Cook, where every person he dated got married immediately after him? So I don't get winners. But apparently anyone who sits here, Adam Hill, he had a middle, I think, on Friday last week. It was either Thursday or Friday. JVT hit a middle on Wednesday. and you come in, boom, five-leg parlay, bring it home, money-line parlay. It comes home. Denver wins 121-119. If you took San Antonio on the points, folks, you're a winner because they obviously do not cover. The over does hit in that game. Let's get updated on the other two games going on. And as we joke, thankfully we had a no-hitter tonight. Joe Musgrove, yes. If you were just tuning in. First no-hitter in Padres franchise history. He shuts out and no hits. The Texas Rangers 3-0 tonight. 10 strikeouts for Musgrove. No walks, but it was not a perfect game. He hit Joey Gallo in the fourth inning. So fortunately we had that because the NBA games tonight, while it's getting competitive in Oakland or San Francisco, but it's still the Wizards and the Warriors. But I want to get to the Clippers-Houston game because this game went off 11. It went off 11 in favor of the Clippers, as you would imagine. And, you know, you and I speculated last night, coming off of the win against the against the Suns. Just rest some people.
You know, right.
Do a Bucks. Do what the Bucks did. Maybe not to that extent. By the way, the Bucks, no Middleton, no Lopez, no Giannis, no DiVincenzo, no Holiday, no Tucker, and they lost to the Hornets tonight. It was 36-26 Houston after the first quarter, and you're getting 11. You're catching 11. Feeling great. The second quarter, the Clippers outscored the Rockets 41-10. I mean, that, man, that's like when the varsity scrimmages the JV. 41-10 in the second quarter. It is a 16-point lead right now for the Clippers. So you're still not out of the woods yet if you laid the points with the Clippers.
You're not. It's back to 16. A 9-4 start to the third quarter for Houston. And I would imagine that this will be a night where we don't see Kawhi Leonard in the fourth quarter for the Clippers, unless if the Rockets are back in this game. And that would mean if you have a Rockets ticket, you're probably in good shape.
The more competitive game tonight, granted against two teams that are not very competitive. Warriors and Wizards now tied 70 all, and triple double watch continues. Russell Westbrook 11 points, 10 assists, 8 rebounds. So he's just 2 rebounds away from his 7th triple double in his last 8 games. That's Jeff Harles. I'm Tim Murray. Who takes Trey Lance in 15 minutes? But got to get my college hoop fix in next, right here on the Nightcap. Action this spring doesn't get much better than this weekend. Our VSiN experts are covering the Masters, early season baseball trends like, hey, no hitters, NHL and NBA playoff races, and every game on the schedule to give you the betting edge. We give you all the tools to cash more tickets, including our 24/7 video coverage, complete data and analysis on VSiN.com, our daily members only best bet emails, and in-depth coverage of every sport in Point Spread Weekly. The weather and the betting action is warming up this spring. Now's the time to sign up for your VSiN 10-day free trial, VSiN.com/subscribe. Jeff Parles, Tim Murray, it is the Nightcap on a Friday night. Once again, no hitter, Joe Musgrove throwing a 10 strikeout, complete game, no hitter, no walks, one hit batter, and a tremendous performance tonight. First no hitter in Padres franchise history. Have you ever been? You've been to a lot of sporting events. You ever witnessed a no hitter?
Oh, I'm going to embarrass myself here. So I was 6 years old, and we had tickets to Yogi Berra Day at Yankee Stadium. The Yankees were playing the old Montreal Expos that day. Mm-hmm. And there was a rain delay, and there was a lot of lightning, and I was a little kid, and I was scared. So we left. The big problem was David Cohen threw a perfect game that day.
Oh, no.
So I have I'm never going to see a no-hitter in person. Like, it's not going to happen, Tim. Like, because of that, because of what happened that day in the Bronx, I'm never seeing one. So
June 18th, 1999.
Yep. I was 6 and 3 days old, basically.
Wow.
Scared of lightning and Early in that game, we at least saw Ricky Ledeay put one into the upper tank at the old Yankee Stadium. And then Cohen throws a perfect game on Yogi Berra day.
It was only a 33-minute rain delay.
I know. Well, what do you want?
Come on, six-year-old Jeff.
I know. Look. If we had known, we wouldn't have left. But I know. I mean, I feel so bad for my dad, who's obviously a Met and Jet fan, who's seen a lot of ridiculous things, and of course, a Yankee game would have been providing the most spectacular baseball moment we would have probably seen.
That was
rough. It was rough, Tim.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I do not forgive 6-year-old me. I do not.
I'm sure your dad doesn't either. So we saw a no-hitter tonight. I've never witnessed one. I called one in the minors. I can't even remember when it was. I remember it was the Salem Red Sox. I think it was 2013 against, they were the opposition. Never witnessed one in person. I did throw a 5-inning no-hitter in I think it was ninth grade. So
very nice.
There you go.
I will say
wreck ball no-hitter. I would say on the same level of what Joe Musgrove did tonight was what I did at Dogwood Park in Rockville, Maryland in ninth grade.
By the way, Tim, actually just jogging my memory here on this. So just showing that I'm never going to see one of these in person after what just messing with karma too much on that one. So Johan Santana, the first Met no-hitter.
Yep.
We were at the ballpark the day after that. So there you go. We missed the only Met no-hitter. Again, R.A. Dickey did throw a good game that following day. That was in the middle of R.A. Dickey's stretch where he was completely unhittable for about a 3-week stretch en route to that Cy Young Award in 2012. But again, I've planned to keep that story about me and the Cone Perfecto under wraps, but I can't lie to you like that.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, we got to tell the truth. we don't all win our bets, and sometimes people leave perfect games. that happens. No note tonight in Texas as the San Diego Padres blank no hit the Texas Rangers by a final of 3-0. The transfer portal is nuts and
crazy.
It feels like it was a long time ago. It was Monday. That we witnessed Baylor beat Gonzaga in the national championship. And on Wednesday, we kind of put a bow on the college basketball season. We had Jim Rudon, and he had put together this Excel file comparing all of the futures odds out there. And I've been kind of staring at it a little too much. When Arkansas picked up yet another big-time transfer today, I'm probably going to mess up his last name, Stanley Amudi from South Dakota, 20-7, texted a buddy who calls games in the Summit League, and he said, prior to Oral Roberts' run with Asemus, that, Amudi was kind of the talk of the conference, this kid from South Dakota. Add that to Chris Likes. Mooney is gone. But Arkansas at 30-1 is certainly intriguing. And then, Jeff, the blue bloods are fascinating to me. You look at Duke, you look at Kentucky. I don't know the next time you'll see a Duke at a 16-1, thinking about the season that they just had and knowing what they may have this upcoming year. And then I'm fascinated by Kentucky because I know, B.J. Boston and a handful of other guys are going pro. They did get Kellen Grady, the grad transfer from Davidson. And the way the wind is blowing right now, it seems like Marcus Carr from Minnesota could be headed to Kentucky. Oof. If he pulls out of the NBA draft. He is declared for the NBA draft, hasn't signed with an agent. But if you're going to get Marcus Carr to go with Kellen Grady, Osko Tshiebwe from West Virginia, he transferred midseason to Kentucky. They've got a lot of dudes and, not great for Kentucky standards. I think their recruiting ranking is like 5th or 6th right now. But still, you're getting talent. You got one blue chip, 2 4-stars coming in. So at 25-1 on Kentucky at BetMGM, now's the time to strike on some of these teams. And I think Kentucky, similar to what we saw last year with Ayu Dosunmu, who we didn't know if he'd come back, and then he does come back, and those odds on Illinois plummet. Now, ultimately, didn't get the cash that ticket, right. But you were feeling good heading into the NCAA tournament. I think Kentucky, if they were to land Marcus Carr, You're going to get much shorter than 25-1.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, just talking about the Blue Bloods, I mean, when are you going to see Duke at this time at 18-1 like they are at DraftKings?
And
you're just not going to see that.
And the one thing about Duke, and I mentioned this, I think, to Jim on Wednesday, is I don't know if they'll get him, but there's a possibility that they could get one of the top prospects in the country and Patrick Baldwin Jr.
Right.
His father is the head coach of UW-Milwaukee, and it seems like it's down to those two, Duke or going to play for his dad. So it'll be interesting to see. And, oh, by the way, Alabama, they are going to be absolutely loaded this upcoming year.
That's the big concern about a Kentucky ticket, because Bama's going to be every bit as good, maybe even better than they just were, winning the SEC regular season and postseason. And they got UCLA in the tournament. What are you going to do?
And, yeah, they've got tons of grad transfers coming in. So, all right, I got my college hoops fix. On a Friday night, we slid it into a smaller pod. I also got a great story out of Jeff that he apparently...
Yes.
And I will make sure that the social team tweets that out just to remind people. I know it's Friday. He thinks it's a Friday news dump. It's not going to happen. I'm making sure we get that bad boy on social media. We'll talk some NFL draft. Where could Trey Lance end up? We'll talk more about that next right here on the Nightcap. Picking at the scab of Jeff Parles. 6-year-old Jeff Parles telling on his dad's sleeve, "Hey dad, I don't want to wait out the 33-minute rain delay. I'd like to leave. I'd like to go home.
I was scared of lightning, Tim. That's all it was. I wouldn't have liked Thor back then."
Yogi Berra Day. The Yankees' third perfect game. Yogi Berra Day.
Yeah, and it was a little bit a year after David Wells threw his against Minnesota, too. Again, that was right in the midst of those three straight titles for the Yankees. But yeah, no, that one, that still hurts.
And do you know who threw out the first pitch that day?
It was Don Larson,
who threw a perfect game in the '56 World Series.
Yeah, no, we still have the pin from that game. We still have the number 8 pin from Yogi Berra Day. And I will say this, Tim, to just put a bow on this whole thing. So I went to my first broadcast experience was as a high school kid at Bruce Beck and Ian Eagle's sports broadcasting camp,
mm-hmm.
which Bruce Beck is NBC New York's sports guy for a long time, and obviously we all know Ian.
Sure.
It was held at the Yogi Berra Museum at Montclair State University in New Jersey, and Yogi would always show up on a Thursday, and I told Yogi, hey, I was at Cone's perfect game, and I was a small kid, and I didn't make it the whole way, and Yogi said something that I can't say on air. That's all I'll say. He said something he can't say on air. So.
I was gonna say, is he gonna say something sort of Yogiism, where like
it was a Yogiism with one word that I was a little questionable for on air goodness here, Tim. But it was pretty funny. We had a laugh, and it's always good to be needled by the best catcher in the history of baseball. Basically.
So once again, Joe Musgrove, a no-hitter tonight, 8,205 games from the start. Tonight was the 8,206th game in Padres franchise history. The Mets, whose streak ended in 2012, Johan Santana,
yep,
did it. Took 8,019 games, mm-hmm. So it was the longest streak ever for a franchise to get a no-hitter. First time in franchise history for the Padres. So no other active team is no-hitterless.
We're good now.
Yep.
Everybody's covered.
Everyone's clear. The Padres are clear as they get it done. A very just an incredible performance from Joe Musgrove. 3-0 the final score, and for betting ramifications. The money line comes home, the run line comes home for the Padres, -124 here. And yes, the under comes home as well.
We're going to have to get the research team on what the number was. I know there's a few books that do this before the season of what were the odds on there being a no-hitter this year?
Oh.
or even a or a total of no hitters since usually you get one or at least one every single year.
Yeah, no hitters are, I mean, perfect games
a little bit
still very infrequent, but no hitters, you're starting to see them. I mean, we got a couple last year too in the shortened season.
Alec Mills had one last year. Caratini, who caught tonight, actually has caught the last two no hitters in Major League Baseball.
Well, there you go. A little history there. So the Padres get it done, a no hitter. Just a quick check of the NBA scoreboard. On a little bit of cover watch here. Clippers starting to pull away after that 41-10 second quarter. They're up, I believe, 92-74 right now on the Houston Rockets. And the Wizards and Warriors had themselves a little game here. 86-85 all. We'll see if the total will come into play. This was the highest total on the board at 240. And it is 85-85 early in the fourth quarter. So that is where we stand. Warriors and Wizards tonight. 240 was the total pre-flop. And I believe in-game you're looking at around 224 right now. So not ideal if you're on the over here tonight with Warriors and the Wizards, and I'll pull that up real quick to see if we have gotten the triple-double.
One board short.
Still hasn't right gotten now. There. 13, 11, and 9 rebounds for Russell Westbrook. Steph Curry has 5 threes and 26 points tonight for the Golden State Warriors.
That Curry guy's pretty good, Tim.
He's all right.
He's pretty good. And again, Golden State is really in the mix for that play-in because of how good Steph has been. Dealt with that tailbone, and then naturally that first game back against Milwaukee the other night, he was completely dominant.
He was tremendous in that game. Now, Giannis didn't play, someone on this set may have had the Bucks before Giannis was ruled out in a money line parlay. Yeah, that was me. And obviously that did not work out because the Warriors won 122-121. NFL draft. We had Benjamin Solek on earlier in this hour. Great stuff there. And making me think real hard about J.C. Horn. It was funny. Now is the time. And I don't know if maybe it's just me. I had said this to Ben about attention turning to the NFL draft after the college basketball's over. That's just me, personally. Because, you know, I was all in college hoops, and then once that's over, you know, 3-4 week ramp up to the NFL draft. I love the NFL draft. You dip your toe in a little bit, quarterbacks and all that stuff, but then you start to really, you know, hone up on the defensive players. And J.C. Horn's that guy to me that just everywhere you turn, you keep hearing people talk about long, rangy type of the cornerback. I did love what Ben said about Justin Fields. That was making me feel very good about my +260 ticket on him going third overall to the 49ers. But what about Trey Lance? Our own Michael Lombardi this week, I believe on his podcast, and has certainly talked about it on the Lombardi line, talked about Washington being very interested in Trey Lance, maybe making a move to go up and get him. Now, the Washington football team is sitting, I believe, at pick 17 right now. So they're going to have to, you know, trade some capital to move their way up to obtain
Washington at 19.
19. 17 is Las Vegas, excuse me. So, yeah, Washington is 19. You have New England there at 15. They could want a quarterback. Maybe Denver at 9. You know, other teams could obviously trade up. You're looking at teams like New Orleans. What's their quarterback situation long-term? Pittsburgh, what's their quarterback situation long-term? As he said about Rashawn Slater, same applies to Trey Lance. Just takes one, right? I mean, we saw it with the Chiefs. Traded up 17 spots to get Patrick Mahomes. So when you look at these odds, Jeff, Broncos are the favorite because they could really stand pat at 9 and likely get Trey Lance or trade something minimal to move up a couple spots to secure him. Falcons at 4-1, 49ers at 4-1, Washington at 4-1, and then you start to get a little bit longer odds. Panthers at 9-1, that seems unlikely after trading, you know, Sam Darnold and the capital that went with him. The Bears at 12-1, that's intriguing at 20th. Anything jump out at you here on this board for Trey Lance?
Not really, Tim, mostly because, and I mentioned this to you the other night, and I mentioned it to Aaron when we were having a discussion a few weeks ago about about Trey Lance. I have no idea what he is. And I really, at this point, if you're looking at the teams on this board, San Francisco's not going to take him at three over Fields or Mac Jones. That number's ridiculous.
It was funny. Last week when we were talking, me and Adam Hill were chatting about who the 49ers would take, and it was 4-1, same odds, actually, for him to go number three, Trey Lance. And I said, yeah, me and Adam were in a bit of an agreement on Trey Lance maybe going four. As time has gone on, and just the more complete prospect that Justin Fields is, I get the intrigue, but at three, you're, in my opinion, you're taking Justin Fields, or I guess Mac Jones because of just the rumors out there. But I think it's Justin Fields because he's intriguing, but he's also more complete. You've seen it on the biggest stage. Trey Lance is really all intrigue right now.
Just going off of these odds, I think by the fall, Denver's the one. Just because I agree with you. Fields, to me, someone's either going to trade up the four to get Justin Fields with Atlanta, or I wouldn't put it past the Lions taking Justin Fields at number seven. I wouldn't put it past them. I mean, do we really think Jared Goff is the future there? Absolutely not. And I would, again, the Ohio State guy going to Michigan's NFL team's a little bit odd, but I would anticipate that that Fields still goes ahead of Lance.
Does he have strong kneecaps, though, with Coach Campbell?
Man, Campbell getting a head coaching job is still amazing to me, but that's a different discussion for a different day because I could go on for an hour and a half on that. But, look, I would say Denver would be the bet I would make. I know they're the short shot, but it just makes too much sense. They're not, it's pretty obvious they're not enamored with Locke long-term there.
No.
And that's one of those where if you take Lance, you can start Locke early in the season. And once Locke has that game where he throws four interceptions, you can go, all right, we're putting Lance in for good now. So Denver 3-1. Again, I'm not a huge fan of betting short shots unless if it's completely obvious. But Denver would be the only play I'd make here.
Yeah, I think Atlanta's intriguing because you have an offensive-minded head coach. You've got an aging quarterback there in Matt Ryan. But at four, it just seems too rich for Trey Lance. Now you got 4-1 odds. But, you know, look, I think Arthur Smith is the type of coach you could see drafting someone like this, right? 6'4", 220. There's no rush to get him in. I really hope that Trey Lance falls to a situation not like Denver, where he might be forced to play.
Right.
You know, I think he's the type of guy. He's a redshirt sophomore. Really, honestly, going into NFL, he's a redshirt freshman. He's not a redshirt sophomore. He played one game this year.
Right.
So he's started one season in college football. By the way, that year, he was spectacular. National champion, 28 touchdowns, no interceptions. He's fast. He's got a big arm. He's young. So I hope he gets into a situation. I know this is they never trade up. Patriots at 5-1. Get him in there with Josh McDaniels. They've got draft capital to move up to secure him. I know they never draft quarterbacks in the first round. I could see that and have him sit under Cam for that 1 year. You know, there's not a lot of financial money wrapped up in him.
No.
And that would be perfect for Patriots. Have a chief quarterback for 4 years and build around that quarterback who has that intriguing skill set. 5-1, New England. Why not? Let's go in on that. 2 hours in the books. Talk some Masters. Top of the next hour right here on the Nightcap.